Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter Llewellyn, and I run the services at medcomsnetworking.com. Those are information services activities for people who work across the world in and around medical communications, medical education, medical publishing, and the associated businesses. You'll find we're doing quite a lot, and we're doing a lot of these webinars. We capture the webinars, recordings are posted at Network Pharma TV. You'll find hundreds of videos there, not just the webinars, but other sorts of video material as well. And particularly to those of you who are interested in joining Medcoms, maybe as a medical writer or account manager or whatever, you can go over to First Medcoms job. And have a look at the resources there, which hopefully guide you into your career, as it were. Today, absolutely delighted, we've got the authors of a new book. Basically, Tim Sparkin and Faisal Ahmed have just published a book. I think it's a few weeks ago, wasn't it? The Ultimate Guide to Digital Engagement in Pharma. So I'm taking the opportunity. I've invited them on just to have an open discussion about digital omnichannel, and I'm sure we'll touch on things like AI and so on. This is a completely freewheeling discussion. We're not sure what's going to happen. Members of the audience who are online today, and we've got a good audience from all over the world, please do share any questions or observations in the text boxes, and we'll weave that into the conversation. So we're going to record for about 40, 45 minutes. Let's kick off just with some introductions. Tim, can I start with you? Tell us who you are, what you do. Just give us a little bit of a picture.
Perfect. Thank you, Peter. And thank you, everyone, for taking the time out on this wet Wednesday to spend a bit of time sort of upskilling and hopefully sort of improving our knowledge around sort of digital engagements and omnichannel and all that sort of good stuff in pharma. So my name is Tim Spark. I've been working in technology communications for almost 30 years now. And I started in marketing in a very different industry, in the music industry. And basically sort of designing synthesizers and computer technology products for Yamaha. I then went to work for Apple for a while, working on their sort of software development around music. And then one of my clients at Apple ran a digital marketing agency, and they said, we need to get someone to come and educate our clients about emerging channels and how to use them. And my whole thing back then was, I don't really know anything about marketing or advertising, but I understand how consumers use these technologies. And they said, don't worry, we're really good at the planning and the strategy. We just need someone to help our clients like the BBC and Diageo and O2 understand how their consumers are using this stuff. And so we did education for clients for around sort of 5 years. And then I set up Congregation. At Congregation, we're a recruitment and training business, and we help teams understand what the future skills they're going to need. And we've got two sort of main products, which is find you brilliant people who are already very digitally advanced, like Faisal, and put them into your business, or to develop learning and capability programs. So educating all of the people you've currently got around emerging channels and how to engage and use them more effectively. And I think what we like to do is we do this for some of the most traditional established companies in the world, like the Unilevers and Coca-Colas and Vodafones, but we also work with technology companies like Google and educating their people. But what I think we do that's very different to others is basically make things very simple. And we make technology quite simple. We don't use complex language. We don't use lots of jargon. We try to make it as simple and straightforward as possible. And I think that's really important when it comes to understanding new channels and how to use them. There's a lot of jargon used, lots of technology terms, which puts people in a bit of a state of fear. I'm very passionate about teaching and getting people excited by these otherwise slightly fear-inducing technologies. We all feel a bit scared when new things like sort of AI turn up, and helping them cope a bit better at that sort of thing. So that's
Excellent.
what I might kind of do.
Excellent. So that's you. Thank you very much, Tim. Faisal, same to you. Just paint a bit of a picture. Who are you and what you've done?
Yeah, I can give you a quick overview. I mean, I've been on here a few times with Peter and stuff. So I work in pharma at the moment. I'd started my career at Amazon when there was probably about 15 of us, so very startup. We went to 1,000 people within a year and et cetera. So great sort of growth there. Everyone sort of knows Amazon now. There I launched marketplace, computer games, refer a friend. Literally, we created all the best UX examples as well. So that was my university, and then moved on to we did. A company that owned all the digital rights for football clubs, for 92 football clubs. So we relaunched their platforms, their websites, mobile, e-commerce, etc. and then moved on to gaming, and then ended up at agency side in pharma, just to sort of help the industry do some good, and now working the client side of pharma as well.
Excellent. Okay, thanks very much. So what'll be interesting, hopefully, about this discussion is you guys have got so much experience outside of pharma, although obviously what we're doing today is focusing a little bit on pharma. As I said to begin with, we're using the excuse that you've just published your book, digital engagement in pharma. So Tim, maybe we're just going to have a freewheeling discussion here, but let's start with explaining or setting the scene. Why did you publish the book? I suppose it's a simple question.
Very good. Okay, so I think it comes back to that point I just made, which was there's a lot of very technical information around digital and how people should engage with it and what platforms and technologies and tools they should use. But what we'd found is working in more traditional sort of non-pharma brands for many years and learning basically how marketing works and how to sort of create consistent and compelling and engaging user journeys. When we went to work in pharmaceuticals, Faisal and I worked on a couple of projects together with a few clients. What we found was there's such a sort of perception that we're very different and traditional marketing rules don't apply. And actually what you need to do is completely rewrite everything because we're a very unique little snowflake and everyone else is completely different. And actually, a lot of the rules are quite similar, and there's lots that we can learn from other brands, particularly B2B brands, and how they tend to use marketing and data to more effectively engage with people. But then understanding some of those simple sort of tools that we can do and simple steps that we can take in terms of pharmaceutical marketing of, you know, I've been running what you'd traditionally call digital marketing workshops for probably sort of 15, 20 years. And what tends to come out of the end of most of these workshops is, I don't understand my users, where they're going, what they're looking at, and what engages them, where are they spending their time? And which is, you know, a classic sort of marketing question, which is, who are you talking to and what do they think at the moment? And that's not a digital thing. That's like consumer understanding or, you know, HCP understanding, which is where we start. So actually, you know, there were so many sort of resonating areas, and it felt that no one had written anything from that perspective of, yes, let's look at the unique aspects of pharma and what constraints we have and what opportunities we have in what we do. But let's also apply some of those classic sort of brand building techniques and tools and frameworks. So we wanted to create a very, you know, the book sort of came out of a workshop that we delivered, which was looking from the start, you know, which is like, where are we at the moment? What's our business objectives? Okay, once we've got an idea of that, who do we want to talk to? What segmentation do we have? How do we segment our audience and how do we talk to them differently? Do we need to do that? What do their lives look like in a digital world? If we think about, you know, what their media consumption was probably 10 years ago versus what they're doing now. You know, even today you have these conversations of our audience isn't very digitally engaged. They like to get traditional publications. They just like to go to the same conferences and things like that. And of course they do those things, but they're doing lots of stuff on top of that. And there's loads of extra things they're doing that you can augment. And you can either ignore those and just say, right, okay, we're just going to carry on channeling, you know, and using the same sort of channels and media opportunities that we have, or you can start dipping your toe into some of these new areas. And, you know, at that point, people say, we need figures, like how many people, we need benchmarks, what levels of interaction can we expect? We need KPIs, we need all of these things before we'll do anything, because we're quite a risk averse area. And we said, yes, of course you can do that. But at the same time, there is a new way of working, which Faisal had sort of, you know, really developed himself and worked on, of just being a bit more test and learn, a bit more agile around the way they were working. So it's kind of like, how do we take some of those core ideas and then, you know, apply them to some of the new channels that people are using from what we understand, you know, in a pharma context, and then think about how you can actually give them some key exercises, some simple questions to ask internally. And one of the other things we have in the book is these sort of digital tools. So if we're telling you to go and look at a specific, you know, therapeutic area, what are the questions, you know, what's the questions that Google say are being asked around those? Is the content you're creating answering those questions? So at the end of each chapter, we have a few tools. And, you know, one of our, you know, key beliefs is that digital is very much is contact sport. You know, the more theoretical you understand it, that's fine. But actually, it's when you get involved in a project, when you start trying to build your first social media engagement campaign or your first website, you suddenly realize, okay, the learning curve that you go through in that sort of 3 months beats any kind of workshop that you can do, because you're just applying those skills every day. So that was kind of where the book came from, and it helped us sort of hang our thinking together. And it's a very simple, it's not a complex book, it's not a long read, you'd probably read it in a couple of days. But the idea is it's kind of a non-linear book you can just dip in and out of. And if you have to do something around social media, what can you learn from some other sort of good practice that we've seen within the industry? So that was where it came from. We've launched it, and we've had a really good response so far. So we're very happy with how things are going.
Okay, so Faisal, let's draw you in. I mean, with your pharma experience on both agency and client side, the obvious question, again, I'm stating the obvious here, but a lot of people talk about pharma as being very slow, very behind the curve, etc. So maybe just talk a little bit. What is your experience bluntly about pharma and their ability to pick up and run with some of this technology?
I think we're definitely not behind the curve, because we actually do, if you look at some of the stuff we do, consumer actually takes some of the ideas as well, from us as well. I mean, we do a lot of workshops, we do a lot of planning, et cetera, as well. What we do really badly in digital is we create the whole product. So we create a website, and I've seen this thousands of times. We create a website, it takes 6 months plus to create. We put all the content on the website, which we've from a PDF or from a detail aid, et cetera. And then you look at all the stats, and everyone goes through a lot of stress in those 6 to 9 months. And you basically get it compliance approved, et cetera. But if you look at all the stats, usually most stats of the websites I've developed and hundreds over the years, HCPs literally come to the website, they're on there for maximum 2 minutes. And they check a couple of pages. So it's we basically, what we need to do is go back and create an MVP. So those 6 to 9 months can easily be a 2-3 page website, get our key messages across in a really short, simple way. And it sounds basic, but we sort of miss the basics quite often.
Sorry, just let me cut in. You said create an NPV.
MVP, so minimal viable product. So,
right, so it's probably worth just spelling that out. Right,
yeah, please. Rather than create 100 pages like we do on detail aids and websites, let's create 2 or 3, test it, see what people are looking at, and then build upon that as well. And take things off as well. If nothing's working, let's take it off.
So it's about iteration, reiteration, measuring, all those sorts of things, responding, which is difficult, isn't it? I mean, in with pharma structures and compliance and all the rest of it, it can be difficult. It sounds great, but it can just be a very clunky system, which just blows things up a little bit.
Yeah, it's a clunky system because we create a clunky system.
Right.
I keep on saying to people, why get stressed over 6 to 9 months creating something which a few people might come and visit? They might spend less than 2 minutes on there, and your content on your page probably takes 5 minutes to read. So let's look at the short, sharp bits, what key messages we want to get across in 2 to 3 minutes maximum.
Okay.
And what we do push as well, and the book starts with this, is think about the customer and work backwards.
Right.
So it's all about the patient, the HCP, and work backwards. That's the philosophy we have. So we have personas. We introduce day in the lives. We look at the customer and see their pain points, and just we don't want to come across those pain points, right?
But from from a speed perspective, yeah. I mean, we're never going to be as fast as, you know, some direct consumer e-commerce brands that are on there looking at conversations, looking at trends, responding to them in real time. But, you know, pace is relative across our industry, and generally the level is quite low. And it's like that story of the two people in the forest, and they hear a bear, and one of them bends down and starts putting on some trainers. And his friend's like, "What are you doing? You're never going to outrun the bear with trainers." He goes, "I don't need to outrun the bear, I just need to outrun you." And it's just, you know, it's just understanding that actually, you know, if we can increase the pace and speed up on these things a bit, you know, we'll start gradually going from, you know, 3 months down to 1 month, that's really good progress. And that's immediately a lot more relevant for the audience than it was, you know, what we did, you know, with all our clients. Like historically, we talk about this idea of building cathedrals in the desert. So building these beautiful sort of digital items, could be an app, could be a website, could be a, you know, social media campaign. And we spend sort of 6 to 12 months developing them for a world that's moved on and no longer cares. And actually, yeah, if it's a cathedral in the desert, what you really need to think about is, A, is it in the right place? And B, are you building any roads to help people get there? What's your distribution strategy? If content is king, if we know content's really important and you've got to make the right stuff, then how you get it in front of people in their busy lives, in parts of the day that make sense to them, is probably more important than the content itself in many respects. It's like how you seed it to them, how you pique their interest and get them to click on the next thing so they discover more, how you can provide it to them in a number of formats rather than just text, maybe an audio, maybe snippets of video or something, again, to sort of get their engagement at that point. And that feels, you know, it's never, we're not trying to be the fastest people across any sector. We're just trying to be a bit faster than competition in our area.
Just to be slightly provocative and overly simplistic about this, have you got a view? Is it, you know, do you find in real life that the farmer, simplify this, farmer clients are more reluctant or more risk averse or more worried? Or do you find the agencies are actually more risk averse and worried? I mean, where, you know, or who's driving it? Who's holding it back? I mean, I know I'm being overly simplistic, but I mean, a lot of people on both sides talk about wanting innovation, yeah, you know, wanting to innovate. I just wonder whether you have any comment on whether you think actually, you know, one side or the other is actually slowing things down.
It depends on what you mean with innovation as well. I don't think, I mean, I've been on both sides, right? I'm currently on the client side. So it's all about bringing the right people on board, right at the beginning as well, and getting them. And I keep on saying this, and I'll say it throughout the whole webinar, is think about the customer, and get the right people in the room, put up those personas, put up those customer journeys, put up the day in the lives, and build something based on the end user. So I always try to say it's all against what we want as an agency or client, but it's actually what the user wants, the
customer wants.
Yeah.
Okay. Just on, let's follow that one then. So this leads us into omnichannel, doesn't it? I mean, that's the whole thing about omnichannel is personalizing content in different ways to the end user, going via the channel. And everybody now, I mean, omnichannel has been talked about for a while, but this year, it seems to me anyway, everybody is talking omnichannel. You know, all the agencies are talking about how they do omnichannel. Just can you tell me what do you mean by omnichannel? Because I'm not sure everybody agrees on that. So what do you mean by omnichannel? And let's just explore that. Actually, how does that work in practice?
It's definitely the buzzword of the year, isn't it?
Definitely, so, yeah.
I don't know if the Oxford Dictionary has put it in as the year. We need a farmer version. I mean, omnichannel came from Best Buy in America, came from Target in America, where they were trying to combat Amazon. This was back in the early noughties. They were trying to combat Amazon. So they came up with, right, Amazon don't have shops, so let's create this omnichannel word where we're everywhere, where we've got a shop, where we're online, etc. And I've seen that in so many pharma presentations at congresses as well, is there's a shop in the omnichannel slide that people put up. We don't do shops, right? So it's hard. Everyone's got their own definition of it. It's just marketing at the right place at the right time on the right platform.
Okay, Tim, have you got a view on that or a definition of your own?
I probably don't have a definition, but the way I think about it is, if we think about how communications have generally worked historically, they've been on the company's terms. So the company chooses when they run campaigns and when they put information out there. And in the second iteration of the web, you know, suddenly users had control and they could go and find things outside those hours and they could look things up and they could read reviews and write reviews. And so it became a lot more of a, you know, people powered situation. I think for me, the idea of omnichannel is basically it's users being able to get information on their terms when they want, rather than waiting for, you know, when's the build up to the next big Congress going to happen. And, you know, actually just being able to go out and look up that information themselves. And that for me is the key thing. It's like having your always on presences so that if people are looking and asking questions and your chatbot's responding to things, you're there to answer those questions when they're proactively doing it, as well as your campaigns. So classic multi-channel campaigns is like, okay, this is what we're doing and we're going to talk about it from March to, you know, June, and then we're probably not going to say anything for a few months. Whereas an omnichannel presence is just always having that always on ecosystem so people can constantly sort of find information if they need it, and then you're augmenting that and building on that yourself with a bit of extra effort and these other pushes that happen. And I think, you know, sometimes we overestimate how interested in people are in our brands, but, you know, to me it's amazing across, you know, most industries now, companies invest billions in sort of creating these amazing sort of marketing platforms, but actually speaking to someone on a phone or directly getting an email back from companies is virtually impossible. And for someone, everyone's like, well, that's crazy innovation. You're like, that's not innovation. That's how we used to do it. We just put all these barriers between the company and the user to make it really hard to do that. Because, you know, historically when I worked at Yamaha, we used to have, you know, we came up with lots of new musical instruments and computer products all the time, and we used to have a thing down at the bottom of the email saying, any email you send us, we will ignore any, you know, basically we'll listen to you, but we'll ignore any product ideas you have in there, because they might get sued, because if that product came out 2 years later, that person could say. So you had to have that very sort of structured, we'll listen to your ideas, but we're not going to, you know, legally, we're not compelled to do anything with them, because if we do, we don't want to put ourselves. So there's lots of, we know every industry has those sort of issues and they have those kind of, barriers. And I work with financial services and, you know, very similar barriers to what you get in pharmaceuticals a lot of the time, quite slow moving a lot of the time. But a lot of them are starting to adopt more agile processes. And, you know, Lloyds Bank has been, you've been working on a project with them for quite some time. And, you know, agile is not some amazing thing that you just get everyone to do all at once. It's just, and I don't even like the term, it's a bit of a sort of militant term. It's more about building agility into the teams that you work with. You know, let's just get one team. If there's a nice business case, let's get one team working that way, which is all about, you know, design, build, learn. We'll design it, we'll build it, we'll test it, and then we'll learn from that. And it's just this nice cyclical process that you go through, which is a bit more user-friendly than this whole, I spent 6 years designing it to launch it to a world that no longer cares.
And that's and one just on omnichannel, Peter, as well. One thing we've got over every other industry is we've got MSLs, we've got sales reps, we've got account managers that can have that personal touch and follow up as well. And that's what people want as well. So that's one good thing. The problem we do have with omnichannel is, as soon as we say the word omnichannel, someone thinks we have to market on every single channel.
Mm.
And then obviously, and then we retrofit a PDF onto various channels. So one key thing is, when you think about omnichannel, think about the platform and then work up, but make it relevant to the user.
It's very difficult, isn't it? And I can just imagine some of the conversations that go on, and, you know, you can't do something on every channel that will suit everybody. So you know, it's pointless pretending you can. So it's about maybe thinking about the fact you want to be on multiple channels rather than just everything, certainly more than one. And I'm just trying to think whether, I think you probably sort of said it, but Paul specifically came in with the question, what's the difference between omni-channel and multi-channel? And I think Tim sort of said a bit about that, but Faisal, have you got a way of encapsulating that difference? And within a client, do you talk multi-channel or omni-channel? And what are you meaning when you're talking those words?
I mean, there's everyone keeps asking the difference. So that's what I'm saying. So it goes back to Best Buy and Target, where they've got the whole channels. They've got online and offline. Multi-channel came in as a digital term. It went digital, right. Then we multi-channel, now we've gone omni-channel.
Okay.
Multi-channel started off just being digital platforms taken from digital. Omnichannel is that offline element as well. And it is literally taken from Best Buy, Target, retail, and then pushed into pharma.
But I think
one okay, of, that makes sense. Sorry, go on.
One of the other things you think about multi-channels, you've got with multi-channel, you've also often got different teams owning different channels and doing slightly different things on those channels. Whereas omni-channel should probably be broadly the same message, but brought to life given the strength of that channel or what people are doing there. So multi-channel is quite often like, you know, you're getting diverse messages across things. You see a different thing on social than you would on the website. You know, holistic, this is semantics. I mean, we get into the weeds a bit, but I think, you know, one of the big things is you start to have different teams. And again, it's to do with how people are structured. You've got web development team over here, and then you've got a content team over there. Often they don't, you know, they're not coordinating. And a holistic omnichannel approach, which is really hard, by the way, it is not hard. It is about getting people aligned and agreed that this is the right thing to do. And, you know, to you know, sometimes that means reducing the number of messages they're sharing. And sometimes it means simplifying the messages, which, you know, often they don't like. But that's the goal. I mean, people think it's about technology. It's not really about technology. It's usually about aligning teams and departments so they're just agreed on a common sort of message.
Again, to be slightly provocative, you know, there's a lot of agencies going, we do omnichannel with us sort of thing. Can an agency do omnichannel, or does it omnichannel have to be done driven from within the client company? Because by definition, they're the only ones that can see all aspects of the journey.
I think they can work in partnership, right? So the agency can work on, say you're talking about creative ideas, make sure the creative ideas are relevant to the channel. How many times have we seen a creative big idea and then they've put it into a banner on various platforms and it's about that big and you just don't get the message across, etc. So think about the message, think about the channel, right? So, and then work upwards. And that's how you can work with the agency, is working on the right creative for the right channel.
But I think Peter's point is fairly one of the big trends we're seeing across every sector is in-housing. So clients building their own in-house teams, because a client's going to give agencies access to all the best of their data. Which data can they have? And it's only when you have that circular loop of create content, test content, and optimize it. If the agency only gets that data once every month, then that makes for a really bad, you know, tough experience. And I can't remember, there was a few clients I saw just yesterday talking about they're just starting to take all their data in-house because they suddenly realized that they've got data sitting with about probably three different networks and 10 different agencies. How are you ever going to align all of your information? Because now with the excitement around AI, all the data specialists are rebranded as AI specialists. And suddenly, you know, people are excited about data for the first time ever in you know, 20 years. And now they're excited about it because it's to do with AI. They suddenly realize, okay, we do need to align this stuff ourselves. So I think it is an optimal organization would probably be most of the data and a lot of the activity being held within the client, and then looking at specific, you know, creative agencies to come and provoke them, get them to test and try new things, and use their sort of, you know, their specialist knowledge to really sharpen the client's message and where they're putting it.
Yeah. That seems logical to me. But also, just to pursue that one a little bit. So a lot of this omnichannel type activity then is repurposing content, isn't it? And let's bring up the AI word. You've mentioned it. Let's talk about AI. You know, I presume there's an argument in favor of, you know, AI tools can be used to repurpose content very easily, actually. And if you've got AI specialists within a pharma company repurposing content, you can imagine it just becoming a machine, and I don't know, is there any limit to that? You know, I mean, is more better and so on, and you know, but you can repurpose content for individual groups and so on very easily in principle, as I see it, with AI. But that takes us in a little bit of a direction which again can be a little bit of a provocative something. So what's your view on how things are going, and as far as not just content for different audiences but like translating content and so on? I was having a conversation with someone this week who just went, it's fine, you know, it's really happening, AI is really affecting translation business, and in-house people are taking content and repurposing it very differently to what they would have been doing a few years ago. Have you got a view on that sort of activity, either of you?
Faisal, do you want to, or shall I?
Yeah, I mean, I can jump in, you can jump in as well. Just, we need to embrace it, right? It's happening. We can create using, is it advertising.ai, where you can create all the different sizes, all the different messages for each platform within a couple of minutes. Using tools like Jasper, you can create a whole marketing strategy, like all your content on emails, your content on platforms, blogs, etc., on social media, Twitter, X, and LinkedIn within 2 minutes. It's there. People, companies are using it. It just needs to, I mean, there are tools out there. We just need to use it, embrace it. But it still needs that human element of checking the content, because we're still day one on AI. It's still day, it's back to the ZX spectrums on AI still. So you'll see a lot of it. It changes every day, but it's just embracing it, test it, and have that human element to double check everything.
I guess what I'm just wondering, and whether you see it or not, but within a pharma company, do you see a development of in-house resource which is about supporting omnichannel, which is actually full of just prompt engineers and people that way inclined? Do you see what I mean?
Not yet. I mean, we haven't confirmed what omnichannel or multi-channel or digital is yet. So we're way off that at the moment. Within the HQ, the commercial, the medical departments, etc., there are tests going on, right? But the AI and the exciting AI is happening in clinical trials. It's happening in drug discovery, and it's been happening for years. And the stuff they're doing in that, pharma doing in that area, is amazing.
But I think at the moment we're at the sort of Wild West phase of this new technology. You know, legislation hasn't caught up. We're really confused about copyright issues. We're really confused about data. Lots of people are doing really inappropriate things of uploading loads of sensitive data to ChatGPT to simplify and synthesize it. No, you know, ignorant, you know, it's not out of spite or anything, but, you know, you need to be wary of, like, is this secure where your information's going? Because ultimately you're using your company data to teach other companies about what may be happening or what products you might be developing. So I think, you know, I'm not thinking about pharma here, because I know lots of other, you know, sort of companies that are working that way. But most of us, I think, it's not become systematized yet. So most companies are kind of working their way around it. It's going to take IT a long time to get their heads around it. Microsoft's got a massive jump on it, because obviously Microsoft, you know, is starting to build it into all of their products like Word and PowerPoint and things like that, which is going to be really transformational. But at the moment, I think it's like people's personal little superpower. So we're all using it a bit on the side. And we use it, for example, we ran a workshop last week and we took everyone's ideas from the workshop, and they weren't branded. There was no sensitive information in there. And I just put it in ChatGPT and said, work your magic on these ideas. And it just, you know, at the end of a day's workshop, you probably have four quite good ideas that aren't written up particularly well. And it takes them and it makes them, you know, elevates them to another level in terms of the language, in terms of some of the nuance, in terms of some of the little things you can do with it. So I think, you know, all of us are using these tools, and I would recommend, you know, get using them personally and just
mess around with them.
Just try using them. And then we sent it to the client and we said, here's your outputs. They're great. Here's your outputs upgraded with a bit of generative AI love. And they were like, okay, that's the one I can show my boss. That's the one that will sell through to leaders. And you realize it's just, you know, there's just little things you can do. So it could enhance content for omnichannel. It totally could. But again, it still needs to be read. You know, I was talking to someone yesterday who works in a software development company. And for most office workers, they reckon it's probably going to improve our productivity about 20%. If you work in programming and code, you're looking at about 150% improvements, because you just don't have to do code checks in the same way anymore. You can put all your code into it and it will check it for bugs and it will come back. And so there's a whole, you know, it's just, it depends on what you're doing and what your job is. There's areas it's going to massively sort of accelerate. There's other areas where we're still sort of finding our way. And I think so in terms of producing amazing new content, I saw a demo a couple of weeks ago, which was, someone uploaded a whole film script to this platform and then it storyboards the whole film. So it just creates all the images for the different scenes. And then you can say it was a sci-fi film and you could say, I want it to be more like 2001 or I want it to be more like Star Wars or WALL-E or whatever. And it would just reinvent all those photos. So, you know, we're at the text phase at the moment. We're rapidly moving to the image phase and then we'll move through to the video phase, which is wonderful and terrifying at the same thing time.
I mean, what one tip for everyone on the call is use Microsoft Copilot, test it out, start using it yourself and see where it can take you.
So what's Copilot, Faisal?
So it's Microsoft's, so Microsoft Office has Copilot generative AI built into it now. And you can test it. I think it's available for testing. I use it every day. So for example, I can take 50 slide presentation, press a button, and it will say, what are the key actions from this presentation? Summarize this presentation. There's various prompts you can give it and it comes back and it's perfect. It helps you write emails. It helps you with Excel. It helps on Teams as well.
I have to just point out, it's Faisal's very lucky because now he's gone client side. He has a big Microsoft account
for
smaller businesses like mine. We don't get access to that for a while. So there might be some people on the call or have access to it. Don't worry if it's not there. It will come at some point, but it's privileged access for.
I was thinking exactly the same thing myself, I must admit. So, but this stuff is happening and coming very fast, isn't it? But if you come back to the basic ChatGPT free version or something, I mean, I'm constantly surprised in medcoms and related businesses how many people have still not had a play, and some of them have been told not to by their companies, but a lot of them are just staying away from it. And I just think, out of sheer curiosity, you know, I think it's worth having a bit of a play with this thing. And you can then argue the toss over whether, you know, the rights and wrongs and what it can do and what it can't do. And we're very worried in our business about accuracy and referencing and citation. And we know there are problems. But if you have a bit of a play with something like ChatGPT, most people go, wow, I didn't think something like that could happen. And I think it's important to have a play. And most of the new guidance, we've got a number of professional organizations at the moment coming out with guidance, roadmaps, whatever they're calling it, ISMAP, HCA, MAPS, and so on. Most of it at its heart is just saying, have a go with it. Yeah. We haven't got a very lively audience, I must admit. Who's out there? We've got a couple of questions coming in. Let's try and.
Is Copilot safe from a confidentiality perspective?
Go on, yeah.
Right, so I'm assuming it must be if it's Microsoft.
Yeah, it's built into your own system. So.
Yeah,
It's totally safe.
So, it's lots of people recommended Gen AI for tons of tasks. We see uses during this webinar. Yeah, recommend some to play with. What in terms of, I think that's sort of Charlotte, you know, so to start with, ChatGPT is the first place. There's lots of different platforms, but, you know, they are definitely at the forefront. If you upgrade to the paid version, you can do image generation on there, so you don't need to go through Midjourney and things like that. So there's always lots of different things. If you look up different platforms, they've got different strengths and weaknesses. But I think the key skill you're developing is better question asking and better prompt writing rather than finding the right platform for you or anything like that.
There are hundreds out there. So you have to be a bit pragmatic about this. Sorry, what are you saying?
There's Google Bard as well. And obviously Microsoft Bing. But you can use
things to have a play with something. Are pharma companies generally pro AI usage from the agencies? So are clients looking to their agencies to be proactive on AI usage or not?
I don't think it's a conversation they're having at the moment. My sense. So there are lots of potential copyright issues. And, you know, we've had this in marketing and advertising for many years of, you know, creating ads that look a bit like something else, that can be an issue. And it has been for a while. But when you're not, you know, I mean, there's a whole issue with using influencers now. And basically, if you've got brands working with celebrities, basically, if they film 20 seconds of a celebrity, they can then potentially create any content. Oh, sorry, I've got this weird plugin.
You're coming up with some decorations there.
they could potentially have that actor, you know, or that influencer in a 90-minute film without any. So they're all having to redraft those contracts that they have with people, which is quite a sort of, you know, that's a big challenge for them at the moment. But that's something that needs to be worked out both with the company and their lawyers, and then it's something that between the company and the agency they need to work out. And for me, you know, a lot of what you can do is you can just get through the obvious stuff really quickly. Like, we're writing a gen AI course at the moment on, it's not a 101 on everything, it's like how to write better briefs. So how can you sharpen your briefs? How can you think of those key pain points between when a client writes the brief and sends it to the agency? How can you really make it a far more instructive and engaging document than they often are? And you know, so one of the things is, if you just, okay, what's 10 cliches that people always use in pharmaceutical ads around, you know, whatever it happens to be, and you just get those out of the way, and then you go, okay, we've parked those 5 cliches, we're not going to use DNA strands this time, we're going to use something else, you know. And then it's just a good way of getting off the blank page. There's this sort of blank page fear at the start of every project, and actually Gen AI is a really, really good way of just getting through that. Just get something out there. For the first 9 ideas are going to be terrible, but maybe the following 3 might be quite interesting and give you something to build on.
I know I did a podcast with Creative Floor in January, I think January this year, and we talked about, it was about AI. I know agencies back then are using Gen AI for pitches, to help them with pitches, which helps speed up a lot of projects.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people jump in med comms to, will it write the document and what the problems are with that? It's, you know, it's, I think my line anyway, and the common narrative is, it's not about doing that. It's about helping you, supporting you as a writer, say, to generate material. So it's about ideation and research. And you're touching on the ideas. You can get some off the wall ideas you wouldn't have thought about, you know, for titles for abstracts or conferences or whatever. It just gives you some fresh thinking, as it were. And then the thing about ChatGPT, to be simplistic about and use that one, it never tires. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. You can have you can start to get involved in some discussion with ChatGPT. It just never gets tired. So, you know, you want some more ideas? Okay, here they are, Peter. And it never moans at you or sighs at you. It just gives you some more. I think that's just interesting. And if you haven't played with it, I think it's difficult to quite comprehend that. So again, my message to people is give it a go. We are going to be running out of time. And I did want to just have a couple of minutes, maybe just we finish on this, because we haven't talked about it very much. We've touched on it a little bit. But the whole question of measuring metrics and stuff, which, again, I think people can get a bit excitable about. People can demand numbers and not really know what they want. And if you give them numbers, then they say thank you very much and put it on the shelf, because it doesn't really help. And I just wonder whether you've got some, just in a couple of minutes, omnichannel is partly about measuring and reacting to, and just give us a little bit of a sense of where you think we're at or where we should be at in terms of measuring and monitoring stuff. On what is important to measure and monitor. Can you do that in just a couple of minutes? I thought Faisal was going to jump in there. Faisal, you want to lead the way?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a guide in the book as well, but it's, you should definitely test and learn, definitely need to add metrics to it, because otherwise what you're testing. The other problem we have is, and I always get this question, is what's the industry standard? And you can't answer that question because we're, as we all know, we live in a compliant industry, and pharma companies don't share their open rates of emails, their click-throughs on banners with the industry. So there's no standard to that. It's what I say is build your own standard, measure it over a period of a year, etc. Look back, and then that's your standard. So every if you're doing an email, you're doing banners, you're doing websites, etc., just incrementally improve on that engagement.
And if you're doing that within a pharma company, as I assume you are, and building your own, do you then commission an agency to work on a project and go, these are the measurements we're going to be using? You see what I mean? And is there any problem in there? You know, I mean, it seems common sense to me, but I just wonder how much the client actually goes, right, these are our baselines, as it were. If you're going to run this website or this event or this activity, we're going to be looking at the following measures and how well that's accepted on both sides of the fence. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I do it personally. I mean, I don't know if everyone does it, but I've come from the other side of the table, from agency side, educating people on what measurement should be done in digital for what, 12 years now. So I've always pushed it from an agency side with the client as well. So I'm pushing it from the client side as well.
Tim, do you find clients, I'm being a bit simplistic again, cliched maybe, clients demanding numbers, but then not doing anything with the numbers? You know, do you find there's still an education process in that, or and do they ask for the wrong numbers? You know, if we're running a an event or something, you know, what numbers are people looking at? Number of people who register, number of people who appear on the day, number of people who engage, number of people who do something as a result of, and often as not, people who want numbers are often disappointed by the numbers. And I always think that's quite funny, because it's all quality over quantity anyway, or that's where I'd go about it. But numbers can be very dangerous, I think, but I don't know how it happens in real life. What do you see happening?
Well, I think there's a number of human issues that are going on there. So the reason people want numbers is because we're risk-averse creatures. So we don't want to look stupid, and we don't want to spend money that we think is going to be wasted. So we have to basically, to buy something, an agency probably has to overpromise and say, we're going to do this. If you give us this, we guarantee this. And if you're setting that as a target, that shouldn't really be a key objective. Your objective should be, is it about awareness? Is it about consideration? Is it around engagements? What, you know, is it about number of meetings or anything like that? You should have a very specific business objective. And then from that, you can start to turn that into comms objectives and KPIs and metrics. But basically, there's four ways you can measure things. You can measure things versus yourself. So how are we doing compared to a week ago, 6 weeks ago, last year? Can we compare to our competitors? Pretty hard most of the time. Most of that data is not generally there digitally in our industry. Or can we compare to alternatives? So if I'm going to spend this on, you know, this digital channel versus, you know, this event we'd be running, what do we look at, and how can we correlate what works between those? And then sometimes, if you're more of an e-commerce company, you can measure versus true ROI. So you can look at, you know, how much you're selling and things like that. So what we try and encourage with clients is, if you've got that North Star, if you've got that long-term objective for your brand goals for the year, how do you break that down into component parts, and which activity is going to address which one? So which is going to be working across awareness, which one's going to be working for consideration and engagement and things like that. And then once you do that, and if you get everyone working to some similar KPIs and metrics across the business, different teams can learn from each other, and you can start to build benchmarks. Or you can start to look at, how's this working compared to 6 months ago? And all we're really looking forward to is improvement over that time. And it may not be amazing, but at the start, you know, a lot of these projects, the metrics are really bad. You know, they're not mm-hmm. something you take to your boss. And that's why agencies will come in with the vanity metrics, which is, here's this amazing thing. We reached 100 million impressions. What's that mean? That doesn't, you know, like that's exactly. Completely. Anyone can do that in seconds using, you know, some very dodgy social media ads, but it's not going to, you know, it's not the right people. It's not doing anything that's going to actually shift the dial for the business. So it's, you know, it's a massive issue between the agency wanting to sell the idea in, which means they slightly overpromise, the client probably not really understanding what their business objectives are at the front, and then finding that medium ground, which comes from a good relationship over time, where you say, actually, we're going to do this experiment. We think we might be able to do this. And from that, we'd hope we get this effect. The benefit, the positive side of what we can do from a digital perspective is we can get data and research back on brand awareness and things back so much more cheaply and quickly. Yeah. Could have historically it's cost 50 grand, 100 grand to do, you know, it's always half the price of the campaign just to do the measurements at the end of it. Now we can get that really, really simply, and we can do those awareness sort of and consideration sort of questions quite soon afterwards. So that's the positive side of it, is, but it does require a lot of setup up front.
Right. Okay. Look, guys, we're over time, and I find some of this fascinating. we skipped over a whole load of stuff. I hope we've given some people some food for thought, but I think we should draw the recording to a halt. I know I can speak for you and say that anybody watching this today or later on the video, you're very happy to hear people. LinkedIn is the easy way of contacting you. So I'm going to encourage anybody watching this to do that and to follow up with you. And of course, the book, The Ultimate Guide to Digital Engagement in Pharma, is there from Amazon and so on. But basically, talk to the guys, okay? If anyone out there is watching this, wants to follow this up. And maybe, what's going to happen in 6 months, 12 months' time? I don't know. The speed with which the technology is happening here. So, it's worth people getting on board and playing with some of these tools, I think. But to come back to the fundamental point that I suppose comes through from your book and from what we've talked about, and I guess it doesn't sound like a new message, but maybe we just keep reiterating it's about the customer. It's about thinking about the customer first and working around that, yeah? And that's the basic message that we're trying to get over to everybody. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording there. I'm going to ask everyone, anybody listening to us online, stick around, we've got a couple of minutes, but I'd just like to ask everybody, the panelists, to give us a little wave and say goodbye. So take care, everybody. Take care. Bye.